Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, silly bumper music. Sorry, the bumper music is not playing today, but anyway. You know, last week we had a hit by the UPS driver, and now I suspect aliens have taken over my computer, which I apologize for that, boys and girls in Radio Land. So let's, with no further ado, and before the next hit squad gets here, let me introduce the world famous, the extremely good looking man among men. He racks out. We give you the one, the only, whose last name will be mispronounced, Ed Denzel of the Missing Persons Podcast. Good afternoon, sir.
Wow, thank you. That's quite an introduction. I hope I can live up to what you just said. Thanks.
Well, I'm sure you will be, but with no further ado, let's hear a little bit about you and what you got interested in you doing a podcast and missing people.
Well, the show that I've had out for about a month and a half now is called the Unfound Podcast, and it can be found on Podomatic and iTunes. And Wayne, I've always been interested in disappearances. I tell the story on one of my first episodes that as a child, and I'm 46 years old, so that goes back to the 70s, I can remember the show In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy and being fascinated by it, you know, with like Amelia Earhart and that and the Nazca lines and all these, you know, all the different episodes. And I think that it's just something that has kept, you know, has been with me my whole entire life. And then just within like the last 4 or 5 months, I just kind of decided to act on it.
Wow. Now, do you have a background in journalism or something that helps you do these shows or?
No, I don't. My background for the last, let's say, 15 years is really in entertainment. I've been a filmmaker. I was an independent filmmaker. Maybe we can talk about that later. I was an independent filmmaker in Las Vegas. I lived there for 13 and a half years. I worked with magicians. I was an actor. My background is mainly in entertainment. But I think just naturally, I'm kind of a very curious, very inquisitive guy. And I love mysteries and things like that. So I try to use all of that to try to create a show that people like. But no, I don't have any training in journalism, although I do write some.
What fascinates me, if I may say, is I too have a background in film and television, right?
And I come
to this because I have discovered later in my life that we have two histories. We have the history that we are told happened, and we have the real history that actually did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in Milwaukee, I can talk to people now that have never heard of the mafia being involved in the city of Milwaukee, but yet it was. And this is a history which just helps us understand why we got to where we got today, right? Things in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely play a part in the future. Wow, this is interesting to say the least. So we don't go down the road of indie film, which I have a show for, by the way, to do with that on. I find those things too fascinating. Now, to you, in your opinion, what is one of the more interesting missing persons cases that people might be familiar with?
That's tough to say. I will pick out one that I recently did because for a few different reasons. I think maybe a lot of other people who host shows like I do, and they're plentiful, there's many out there, might say the Mara Murray case. They might say the Jennifer Kessie case, which happened over in Orlando, not far from where I live. I got to tell you one that it caught my attention, and I really think it's interesting what the mother of this disappeared son did with it was the disappearance of Jason Jolkowski in June of 2001. Here was a good young guy, 19 years old, was walking to a school to meet a coworker who was going to drive him to work. It's, you know, like a 10 to 15 minute walk, beautiful day in Nebraska, kid up and disappears, son up and disappears, has never been seen again. And his mother, Kelly Murphy, because of what happened, she turned, you know, her, you know, all the sadness that she felt, and she wanted to do something to help other people who were in her same situation. She started Project Jason, and it's a nonprofit organization built to help other families who have lost sons and daughters, people who have disappeared. And that's a case that kind of haunts me because it's a beautiful day in Nebraska, not in some suspicious area. The kid was as clean cut as you could get, gone.
Wow.
And those kinds, and that one sticks out to me. And any of those other kinds where it's a good person who just seems to be going about their day and disappears seems to me to be the ones that are the, you know, just the most confusing ones, the biggest mysteries, and you just wonder what went on. Although I've covered, you know, other cases where the facts are a lot different. But the Jason Joukowsky one is, I think, one that will always stick out to me.
I hear that. I understand why, because you would think that in America today, walking to meet a friend to be during their work would be a pretty safe activity, and
yeah,
wouldn't rest assured that you can get there, right?
Yeah, right. And, you know, and what I think also about it is how his mother, you know, turned that, you know, was trying to turn it into something good. And that is a common theme you find among parents who have lost children. I got to talk to Mary Lau, who's the mother of Suzanne Lau, who disappeared in Albany in 1998. She's another woman, a mother who turned the disappearance of her daughter into a positive by starting her own nonprofit organization. I had Glenn Dean Grant, the mother of Jesse Foster, who I interviewed for the show. Jesse Foster disappeared in Las Vegas in 2006, and her mother also turned it into a nonprofit organization, trying to do, you know, turning the tragedy that they've experienced, you know, into something to try to help other people, which I think is so good, you know, it's so good, even though it's tragic circumstances.
Oh, absolutely. I can't imagine the feelings
no.
I would have if something happened to my children, my grandchildren.
Right, right. I know, and I don't have any kids, so I can't even imagine what that would be like. And I tell these people that I you know, I'm just trying to get your story out there. I cannot even begin to realize how you feel. I have no idea.
Yeah. Again, my heart is full of sympathy for these parents or children of missing parents because, you know, to me, you always question yourself, could I have done something different? If I would have went here versus there, would I have been able to find them? You know, the blame that I myself would have if something happened to one of my children or my wife or something, I would live with forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So all I try to do on the show is try to track down some cases that people maybe don't know about. Some of the ones, you know, they're probably like, if you don't know, they're probably like 20 cases out there that it seems like every person who's into this must cover because it's so popular. And I'm going to do some more popular ones, but I'm going to be looking for some more obscure ones too. And in fact, that's going to be part of the next batch of cases and episodes that I release. It's going to be a couple stories that probably people haven't heard about.
Absolutely. And obviously, all the coverage we get in these stories are important, but I'm sure there's many people who have a situation, tragedy in their family that no one's talking about and would welcome your ability to help get their story out.
Yep, well, they can always find me. I mean, I'm on Twitter, Unfound Podcast. They can email me, unfoundpodcast@gmail.com. I can tell you already, I've probably taken 5 or 6 recommendations from cases from as far away as Australia. A person emailed me to tell me about a case that he thought I should look into. I'm open to suggestions.
That's wonderful that you're doing this. I mean, to me, and I'm no expert, I see what you're doing as a boon and benefit to families who are looking, if only for closure, they're still looking for something.
Yeah, they don't like to talk about closure. They just talk about getting case resolved because,
right.
You know, closure, I don't know, it's like a cliche by this time, I think, because the pain, no matter if even if a lot of these cases were, you know, solved tomorrow, the pain never goes away.
No.
It doesn't,
uh-huh.
You know, so there is no closure. It's just, they just want answers.
Yeah.
You know, they just want answers.
Yeah, and hopefully the people who are missing are found safe someplace. But yeah, you want to know the answers. You want to know why it happened, what happened. Yeah, you want to know those things. I know I do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we talked in one case, they just talked about a couple of things. A couple of cases. You have others that we might be interested in hearing about, sir.
Well, I started this show Unfound with a case that is kind of I wouldn't call it offbeat, but it's a little off the, you know, once again, it's a case maybe not a lot of people know about. Is besides my fascination with disappearances, I also have a kind of a weird fascination with plane crashes. I'm like an encyclopedia of plane crashes. You know, you tell me like a year and I can probably tell you the passenger jet that crashed, and I've watched all like the Mayday episodes and air crash investigation episodes and things like that. And I kind of combined that for the first case that I covered, and that was the disappearance of Ben Charles Padilla in the country of Angola in Africa in 2003, where he was kind of an aircraft engineer working on this plane. He had a couple guys working for him. And one day, like I said, in 2003, he and then one of his assistants went out to this 727 that they'd been working on for a while. They got in the jet. They were supposed to just test the engines. The jet started going down the runway, took off. Neither Ben Charles Padilla or his assistant or the jet have ever been seen again.
Oh, wow.
And that happened in 2003. And as you can imagine, back then, there was a lot of fear of maybe terrorists getting a hold of the plane. And so for that first full-length episode of my show, I managed to track down Tim Wright, who is the author of what I would call the definitive article about that disappearance. And he wrote the article for Air and Space magazine. And I had him come on my show. And I interviewed him for about an hour and a half about how he got involved in because he's an aviation enthusiast, and how he tracked down all these people that were involved, who owned the plane and who was leasing it and everything. Fascinating story. And really, it's a little bit of a story that should worry the average American, because these kinds of planes, you wouldn't realize how easily they can be stolen, and all the hijinks and shadiness that goes on in the second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand jet aircraft market. And Tim Wright told my listeners all about it. It was quite a show, and that was the first show that I did.
Yeah, it seems to be quite a show. And it'll be a show I'll be listening to, because I'm somewhat familiar with what you're talking about due to my fascination. My biggest thing is our war on drugs, and the more I dig into it, the more I find there's a lot of interesting shenanigans going on with all kinds of most interesting people that we should be knowing more about.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because Tim Wright said that a lot of these jets that disappear, they get their registration numbers changed and repainted everything, and a lot of them do end up in the drug trade, flying drugs here and there all over the world.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And like naval piracy, you know, once they're done with the ship or plane, they can easily get rid of it. And sorry about the crew that might be along with it, you're not going to be seen again. Yeah.
Right.
It's strange to say the least. But you'd think now that with our radar and all the other good stuff, we would know where any particular plane was at any particular time. But unfortunately, that's far from the case.
Yeah, we found that out with Flight 370, didn't we?
We did.
Malaysian airliner.
And they have no idea what possibly could have happened to that plane, do they, yet?
They found some parts have washed up on the east coast of Africa and a couple of those islands around there. Tim, who, like I said, out on the show, has also done some work on that. And he, among a couple other people I follow on that particular topic, really believe that they've been searching in the wrong place for that jet since the beginning.
What do they think?
I mean, they're just Well, I'm not an expert on that. They believe that it crashed into the Indian Ocean down there in the southern Indian Ocean. But where they've been the last, however, you know, year or year and a half, trawling that area with sonar and all that, it's just a little off. They're probably off by like a couple hundred miles. But
wow.
that's just a theory. Just by the misreading of the data that the plane was transmitting at the time. But, you know, until they find the plane, you know, who knows who is right.
Right. I mean, we only have speculative thought it would happen to Amelia Earhart.
It's
been how many years? You know, and by now,
it's 1937.
Yep.
1937 or 1938, yeah.
Yeah, and we won the Second World War, so all the Japanese records are available for us to go through. Those islands are under, you know, anybody can visit those islands, and I know people have, but yet we don't know more today than we did in the 40s.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mention that, because I have on my list of things to do as far as future shows, I would love to have an Amelia Earhart, you know, investigator or somebody like that on the show. That's definitely on my list of things to do. I'm going to just throw that out there that I might like to get the guy who heads up that Tiger organization, T-I-G-H-A-R, which I forget what it stands for. But they've been doing a lot of work over the years involving her disappearance. You know, I might try to get him on the show. Just hard to say.
Well, absolutely. I suspect, sir, that with what's going on in this country around the world today, you could do two shows, three shows a day for the rest of your natural life and still not only reach the top of the bucket.
You know what? That is a very, Wayne, you make a very good point there. And that's why I tried to talk about that on my show. That the way I see myself on my show, I'm not an investigator. I'm not flying all over the world tramping through the jungle or going to a city. I'd hope to be able to afford that one day and investigate some of these things myself, but I'm just a reporter. I go and find the people who have the information, who have done the studying, who have been there, who have been emotionally affected by whatever happened, and I get them to come on the show and I let them tell the story. I just kind of my show is simply a way for them to get their stories out. And that's why I talk about on my show. I'm just a reporter. The people I'm going to try to get to talk to my listeners, they're the ones who are experiencing it every day. I'm just doing a show a week. These people live it every day. So I try to point that out.
No, yeah. And I appreciate that you're doing the show because, again, if let's say I'm just going to make up a horrific scenario in my own family. My grandson walks to school about five blocks away, right? One day he leaves for school, he never gets there, right? And the police and FBI do everything we possibly can do to find him, and he's not found. Simply because I can talk to someone like you or yourself or someone like you, it helps me get information out there, and who knows who might have seen something. It also helps me and other people understand that we have to, because we don't know what's going to happen any one particular day in our life, to make sure that we're studying in good nature with your loved ones. I mean, I say goodbye to my wife each day, you know, or good evening when she comes home, because I don't know what's going to happen, right? And many people never regret, oh, I wish I would have had that fight, I wish I would have said goodbye, or I wish I would have hugged them, because I'd never have been able to do that again.
I would admit, with the show, the kind of show, and this is not just with my show, but of all these other shows, I don't know how much help we can give on cases that are, absolutely brand new. You know what I mean? Like within the last month or something. But we're certainly good at bringing back into the public consciousness cases that maybe people have forgotten about, whereas I think still with newer cases, things that happen, the best way is still the police and these other organizations, like some of these nonprofit organizations. I think for newer cases that have happened, they're still probably the best way to get the information out there. Whereas you get 5 years down the road, 10 years, 15. I'm looking at a case that I'm going to be covering shortly that's 31 years old. Then probably a show like mine or another show like mine is good at bringing out the attention for that, because the police, unfortunately, at that point have moved on. And if there is a go ahead, please.
No. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, it's all right. Go, please. You're doing the interview. I will answer any questions you got.
No. This is your time to shine, sir. How long in most – let me rephrase the question. Again, using the horrific situation, say my grandson disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it usually take before they get recovered normally, in your opinion?
Well, that's tough to say. If somebody like Kelly Murphy, who has, like, from Project Jason, has all those statistics about how many people disappear every year, how many people are recovered and are found and everything, if it's a young child, then you can report that child missing under the age of it depends on the state now, but under 21, under 18, immediately. If it's somebody older, 23, 25 years old, you know, the police are not going to take it seriously until it's at least 2 or 3 days. And then even then, there may be extenuating circumstances where it might not be for a longer time. But the truth is this, if somebody is disappeared for like a year, the odds of that person being found are very slim, and the odds of that person being found alive are very, very, very slim. Not to say that it doesn't happen, because it does, but it's very slim.
Yeah, I remember there were three women in Ohio that were kidnapped by a very sick individual who kept them for, I think, 5 and 6 years. And they were found eventually. And which is
and
good.
You know, and that's a story. That's a story where a lot of family members who hear a story like that, their hopes get rejuvenated. They hope, well, maybe that's what my son or daughter that disappeared, that's what they're going through right now, and something good will happen. And I'm telling you, probably within the next few years, we'll probably hear another story like that. But once again, it's rare.
Yeah, rare. And, yeah, then you want justice to come down and put the people involved someplace, preferably, in my opinion, in a gurney getting an injection. But that's my opinion. I tend to be an asshole when it comes to people being kidnapped. Baltimore. Now, what fascinates me about – let me ask you this question. I'm sorry, let me rephrase it. Offhand, how many people do go missing in the United States each year?
I'm going to tell you that I don't know that number off the top of my head. I don't have that number in my mind. Let's put it this way. If I were to tell you the number, I know I've heard it many times, although I can't remember it. Got a lot of numbers up there in my head. It's distressing. It's to the point where if you don't believe in UFOs, you could believe in UFOs were coming down here and kidnapping humans. It's that kind of number. The big problem we have in the – it's huge. It's a huge number. Now, you have to understand, a lot of those people end up being found. The problem we have in the United States is there are not statistics right now that law enforcement keeps as to what happened to those people and why they were recovered. I mean, for example, with murder, they keep statistics, how many people were stabbed, how many people were strangled, how many people were shot, how many people were committed suicide. In disappearances, nothing. It's just disappearance. And until law enforcement in the United States starts documenting why these people come back, where were they, we're never going to have a really true good handle on why people disappear and why some people stay disappeared and why some people come back.
I know in my own life, as I reflect, I was married to my first wife. We had a mutual friend that was in an abusive relationship, and the only way she could get out of it was, in fact, to vanish.
You want to say
a couple of years afterwards, she'd get back in touch with people and said, I had to leave the situation, so I simply left. So I put you through hell for a year, but, I needed to make sure I was safe. And, she needed to make sure she was safe. We really don't know.
And there needs to, and as many of these missing advocates will tell you law enforcement needs more training. Missing persons divisions in police departments are seen as the bottom of the barrel department. Everybody wants to maybe be in bank robbery or homicide. Missing persons divisions in law enforcement is considered to be bottom of the barrel. That's another problem. Oh. That's something that has to change in the United States.
Yeah, to me. And this is me. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I don't play one on TV. But to me, the person looking for my grandson in the horrific case I came up with is a hero. I mean, all people working law enforcement are pretty much heroes, with the exception of a few, right? But yeah, you know.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the police officers themselves. They just don't get the proper training.
Right.
Okay. When they start, they just don't.
No. And thank you for correcting me on that. I appreciate it. So where can we find you on your podcaster?
I have a Twitter account called Unfound Podcast. You can find my show on Podomatic, Stitcher, and iTunes. I'm a little bit strange in that I upload a bunch of episodes at once instead of like once a week. So I will go, like, I uploaded three, like, not quite two weeks ago. I'll be uploading another three sometime this coming week, if not next weekend. But you can find me there, and my shows tend to be a little longer than their standard true crime show, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well,
if I could bring up one more thing, because we had talked about this, like, yesterday. I wanted to bring up Oscar Goodman. I know you're a fan of his, right?
Yeah, right.
I wanted to mention this to you. If we have some time. Do I have a couple minutes?
Wait.
Do I have
a couple minutes? Easy.
Okay, great. Just a little bit off topic, but being that I'm so happy for you to invite me on the show, I want to try to return the favor. Being that you're an Oscar Goodman fan, I want to tell you a story about him. I was an independent filmmaker, Las Vegas, 2001, working with some friends of mine. And we were putting together an independent movie that had to do with Las Vegas politics and the mob. The movie ended up coming out. It's not a very good movie, and I would not recommend anybody. We were a bunch of amateurs just having some fun. The friend of mine who I was doing this movie with said, you know what, it'd be cool if we could get Oscar Goodman, who was the mayor of Las Vegas at the time, to be in the movie, being that he was a mob lawyer and he had been in some movies. I said, okay, I'll do it. I called his office. Left a message with him. Morning, I'm going to say it was May or March, April, May of 2001. He calls me at home. I'm out of the shower. The phone rings. It's before I had a cell phone. Go to the phone, pick it up. Said, hello. Said, is this Mr. Ed Denzel? And I said, yes. Hello, Mr. Denzel. This is Oscar Goodman. I said, Mayor, what's up? And so we had this conversation. I sent him the script. Regarding this, so we talked a little bit. I told him I was a filmmaker, sent him the script. Now, he chose not to be in it because I think he figured out, this is just a bunch of amateur young kids doing this. But Oscar Goodman called me at home while I was a resident of Las Vegas. I got to talk to him. Fascinating story.
It is. That's our little English friend telling me it's time to say goodbye. So I really want to appreciate you. You come in and then the show, we will be talking soon because I want you to talk about your film career and my other podcasts that I do. It'd be really fun and the like. Nice story about the mayor of Los Angeles, who I've heard only good things about. Excuse me. But with that, I wish you the very best with your podcasts, and I will be making sure I download and listen to them all because I'm sure, like you, they will rack out.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, Wayne.
Have a great day, sir.
You too.
Bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. For the show, I really appreciate it. I really appreciate the people getting involved and active on the Facebook page, Milwaukee Mob. My email would be, of course, themilwaukeemob@gmail.com. And we have a webpage up at themilwaukeemob.info, I think. That's it, that info. But this Google Milwaukee Mob will find it. With that, and this show, I'll blow it up there too as well, but you can always catch it on the links that I've thrown up before earlier today, and we'll be up later as well. But that again, I want to thank everybody for being part of the show. I appreciate the words of support, and talk to you all later. Yep, bye-bye.